So today's ceremony is called Sangye, Japanese for Sangye, the ceremony of contrition and conversion. And before we get, so this is a ceremony about, well, let's put it in context. So here we are at Jukai, we're involved in the training of the monastery, the searching of the heart and cleansing karma retreat. We've heard about the precepts, we've promised to keep the precepts, and now we're going to go into how we train with and how we kind of practice and what the practice of the precepts is like. In a way, I once ran into a fellow in a convenience store in Ojai, California, and I was wearing my robes. I was getting gas there, and he said, "Oh, you're a Buddhist monk." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, yeah. I met a couple of Buddhist monks. I went to some empowerments with a Tibetan monk, but they didn't really seem to, you know, do much for me." And I was thinking about it. I told him, "Well, the thing about empowerments is that we have this idea that we're going to go to this ceremony and we're going to get an empowerment. That means we're going to kind of step beyond. We think to ourselves it means we're going to step beyond the thing that we're empowered to do. This empowerment is going to give us some kind of special ability that will take us beyond where we are, where what we're dealing with. But in fact, what the empowerment does is it trains you how to deal with that thing. And it leaves you in the place of then dealing with it. And actually dealing with it, taking what you've been taught and dealing with it, is quite difficult. Is where the, kind of metal hits the road. And it's by dealing with it that we get to the place that we expected to get by having the power. So in a way, this ceremony, this ceremony of contrition and conversion is like an empowerment for how to deal with past karma, how to deal with our faults and limitations. Before we get into the specifics of the ceremony, I wanted to refer back to something that came up in our last talk, and that ties in with this. I mentioned in our last talk that I had met, over the course of my training, I've met many different kinds of people and teachers, and some teachers that I've met have left the Sangha under various kinds of cloud, in various sorts of states of dishonor. And some of those people have been quite advanced, masters of the order, masters of Buddhism, people with deep religious experience. And there's a question there about how we deal with that. How do we deal with that? How do we understand that? What's going on there? Because when you kind of, on the face of it, what you realize is that everybody who you go to that is a teacher is a human being and has faults. So what is the story? They're kind of setting themselves up as being better than the rest of us in a way, knowing more. What's the story about that? What's going on with that? And it's a difficult thing to train with, to come to understand, and it's an ongoing issue. How do we train with one another as human beings? One way that I understand this and deal with it for myself, because it affects me, it's affected me quite directly recently with Reverend Master Echo departing. And so for me, one of the ways I think about this is to understand it in terms of what are called the five fetters in traditional Buddhism, or the four stages of practice in traditional Buddhism. In in the Theravadan tradition, and this is slightly different than how we look at it, but I think it informs how we look at it. In the Theravadan tradition, when you enter into training, there are said to be four stages that we go through up to the point of becoming an arahant. And an arahant is viewed as a person who has completely severed their acting on greed, hate, and delusion and creating new karma for themselves. So there are four stages that you go through up to the point of becoming an arahant. And associated with those four stages are various fetters that bind us and obscure the truth from ourselves. They distort our view and they cause us to create suffering, being bound by those fetters. And at each stage, we're dealing with some part of those fetters, some part of those things which entrap us. So for the stream entrant, the person who is at the first stage of the holy life, and the way that it's viewed in Theravada Buddhism is that you have people who are practicing, they're practicing, and then at some point they become a stream entrant. And then they're said to be in the holy life, or in the sort of more advanced stages of practice. So when you become a stream entrant, the fetters that you have dealt with are the view of an unchanging self, doubts about the three treasures, the rules, and karma, and dependent origination, and adherence to wrongful rites and ceremonies. Now, it's interesting that in the commentary, so basically what you're doing, what's happening when you become a stream entrant is that you're saying, oh, I really do have faith in the three treasures, and I'm going to take refuge in them, and what the Buddha taught in terms of karma and dependent origination. I believe that this is true, and I'm going to change my behavior so that I can accord with these teachings. So those are the first of the three fetters. A once-returner is the next stage. And at that stage, they attenuate, but don't completely eradicate, sense desire and anger. So in other words, the things that they're looking at, that what they're doing is they're taking the three treasures, what they've learned from the three treasures, and they're applying it to their mind, and they're applying it to their greed and their anger, in this kind of linear way that the Theravadins look at things. And at this stage, what they're also doing is firming up and solidifying their practice of the three treasures and their faith in karma and dependent origination. And this is in the traditional commentaries. Then you become a non-returner. And a non-returner eradicates sense desire and ill will. So this is the third stage of practice. This is, you know, quite significantly along the way of practice. And again, all this time, the way that we're doing this, the way that we're eradicating these fetters and dealing with our doubts is by applying the practice, applying our faith in the three treasures, applying our faith in karma. Because karma is difficult in a sense to have faith in. And then when a person is approaching becoming an arahant, they're working on, there's said to be seven, anyway, said to be number five fetters, I don't know. They're working on the remaining five fetters before they become an arahant. And they are attachment to form, attachment to formlessness, pride, restlessness, which is sort of like being uncomfortable sitting still, that kind of agitated, uncomfortable sitting still, and ignorance, or the delusion of the self. So when you become then, so then when you become, in the sense of the Theravadins, the highest, the most deeply realized of Buddhist practitioners, that is when you have kind of come to deal with these, the final fetters. And the one that I kind of think about most with regard to teachers who go astray is the fetter of pride and the fetter of self-delusion. It is useful to me to recognize then, because I'm not an arhat. I have to admit it, I'm sorry if you're disappointed, but I'm not. It is helpful for myself to look at, in terms of my own perspective and in terms of my own life, oh, well, I've got a whole bunch of fetters that I'm still working on. I'm still working on letting go of these defilements, these taints. And that puts me into a very kind of difficult and awkward position, because here I am sitting in front of you explaining the Dharma to you. I don't know if you can kind of imagine what it feels like to recognize that you were actually completely inadequate to explain the Dharma, and then to set yourself up to explain the Dharma. Let us say that, and this is important, and I say it in tongue-in-cheek, let us say that it is a good opportunity for me to be working on pride even before I become a non-returner and am going that last stage to become an arahant. And so it, the reason I'm bringing this up is so that we... Oh, one further thing. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a section of the Lotus Sutra, much of the Lotus Sutra, is dedicated to a thing called predicting Buddhahood. And one of the kind of radical things about the Lotus Sutra is that it goes through and predicts Buddhahood for all of the arhats that were disciples of the Buddha. So what the Lotus Sutra is basically saying is, well, you know, you guys have said that you're arhats, but there's actually more training for you to do. There's the training of becoming a Buddha. And you will become Buddhas. And everybody's kind of going, Shariputra's kind of going, oh, wow, that never occurred to me. Wow, great, thanks. I was wondering what I was going to do. Thank you. So even though there is a view that when you become an arhant, you cease to train, there is another view from the Mahayana perspective, which we are in, where even though you're an arhant, there is still more training. What this says to me as a trainee is that while I need to be able to go to teachers and ask for advice about how to train, I also need to be able to let go of my expectations of how they're going to behave and how they're going to be. And that's a hard place to be. Fortunately, I have met teachers who are quite solid and quite sane in their practice, and who know deeply about training and have been able to help me. And fortunately, some of the teachers who I've gone to who have found difficulty for themselves have also been able to help me, because all of what they taught was not incorrect. So as a trainee, we need to be able to understand, and as we participate in the Sangha, we need to be able to accept that the Sangha is made up of human beings all along this continuum of training toward enlightenment, knowledgeable and unknowledgeable. We're all a mixture of delusion and enlightenment. Even after we can recognize in ourselves, I am an arahant, and if you're recognizing in yourself, I am an arahant, I think to myself, alarm bells would be going off, because it's like saying to yourself, oh, now I'm meditating, and you realize, oops.
No,
I'm not meditating. So, it's a very subtle and tricky thing. And what ends up happening when we engage with this problem, when we embrace it, we realize the Dharma itself, what the Buddha taught itself, the practice of the Dharma itself is where enlightenment is. And this is what the teachers, this is what people like Dogen are constantly pointing us back to. Go to the Dharma, go to practice, go to your sitting cushion. That's where you will find peace of mind. That's where you will find your enlightenment. It won't be found in the actions of others outside of you. And if they're teachers who are worth their salt, they're going to be constantly pointing you back to that cushion, back to your own practice of the precepts. And in that way, we are continually working on our deepening faith and deepening understanding of the three treasures, the law of karma, and dependent origination. Because all of those things are pointing us back to our own training and practice. And interestingly enough, over the years, like I say, on my... I've got these various documents. You know, in our tradition, we're kind of really fond of documents. I've got my lay ordination certificate, my lay Ketchin Nyaku, my lay Wagesa, my ordination certificate as a monk, my various certificates that certify the ranks that I've gone up through, my transmission silks and certificates. All of these are signed by people who are no longer priests of the order, no longer members of the order. There are people who have left in disgrace and created suffering, sometimes deep suffering for other beings. So this is a really kind of sobering position I find myself in, you know? Oh, well, isn't that interesting? And because I look at myself as well and think, am I really any better? Can't tell. So far the Sangha hasn't said, we don't really want you to be teaching, we don't really want you to be kind of representing the order. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, at least so far so good. Okay, not getting into real serious trouble here. And my own particular orientation is to, well, there was when I was a layperson, I worked as a school bus driver for a while, and I had to do a training program for being a school bus driver. And at the end of the program, they're all the people who are kind of going through this training work all together in this room, and the general manager of the company woman was kind of talking to us, and she asked the group of us, all of us newly minted trainee bus drivers, who among you think that you're not really good enough to be a school bus driver? And I raised my hand, and maybe like three or four other people raised their hands, and oh God, okay, sorry, I just didn't do a very good job. She said, you're the people that we want to work for us. I was kind of surprised. And it made me think, oh, okay, well, this person is actually fairly wise, I think. Because what she recognizes that when you... And so, for myself, my orientation is to think that I'm inadequate. This is kind of my basic orientation toward life, I think. It's a mistake. I mean, it's suffering, but there it is. It's my particular angle on suffering. And it has its uses, as that woman kind of pointed out. Because what it means is, I'm constantly trying to think, okay, I didn't do very good there, so what can I do better? How can I do better? But again, it's a mistake. It's a mistake in the same sense that thinking that I'm adequate is a mistake. Thinking that I have a self that is one way or the other is inadequate. And that goes to the problem of pride. Now, the important thing about these fetters that I'm talking about, it isn't... the Theravadins, again, they've kind of nicely laid it out in a kind of organized way, and you can kind of think, okay, well, pride, I don't have to worry about that, I'm going to worry about that when I become a non-returner. But no, in fact, we're dealing with all of them all the time, and we're constantly kind of working on these as we go along in our training. And it is by the process of going through training, by going through the difficulties of training, by going through the difficulties of our relationships with the Sangha, that we actualize the working on these problems. Okay. So that's my precursor, okay, to what we're going to be talking about today: Sangha, ceremony of contrition and conversion. Yeah. Now, what this is, this ceremony represents in terms of our practice, is the willingness to look at ourselves and recognize that we have the potential and the actuality of making a mistake and doing harm, and being able to look clearly at that and express our regret for it and our willingness to do something different, do things differently. Okay. So, and this has really broad implications. Most of the time, we think of ourselves as being, decent people and really not doing anything that wrong and being basically kind of, nice or whatever. And that's basically true, I'm sure, for most of us. I'm sure there are some of us who are actually doing really horrible things, but anyway, that's another story. And so what we're doing in practice, though, is going a step beyond that ordinary mind, where we're just basically decent people and okay, and looking more closely at what's actually going on in our minds, what's actually going on in our life, the details of what our decisions are and how where they're based and what we're doing with them. And so this process of Sangha, this process of willing to say, I could be wrong, or I am wrong, is a deeply important element of practice. It's a deeply important element for working on pride, the sense of self, the ignorance of, and the ignorance of just self-delusion. In the ordination ceremony, and again, the ordination ceremony has all these different elements in it, there is a verse. Which is used for expressing the idea of contrition and conversion. All the evil committed by me is caused by beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. All the evil is committed by our body, speech, and mind. I now confess everything wholeheartedly. In the commentary for this, and in one of the verses that's recited just before this, in this ordination ceremony, it says there are two ways and two methods for confessing our faults. One is this verse, basically, the essence of this verse, all wrong actions, behavior, and karma created by me. But the other is meditation itself. Now, again, I think I've told you on my wall, just next above my light switch, right next to my door, I have the verse from Dogen: the determination to see things as they truly are, free from preconceived notions, free from preconceived ideas, results in the emergence of true practice. To me, this embodies what we're doing in meditation: looking clearly at ourselves, seeing clearly what's going on in our minds, And so this idea of confession and conversion, the idea of seeing our faults, is embodied in meditation. Just being willing to look clearly and stillly with the eyes of compassion at what we have done. To be able to say it out loud also has its own kind of significance and power. We don't usually do any kind of like formal, like in the Catholic Church, where you're kind of listing all your faults publicly or whatever. But to say publicly, I am a human being subject to the possibility of making mistakes, and in fact, I have made mistakes. And those mistakes have led me to suffering and led other beings to suffering, has a great kind of potency and power to it. So the way this ceremony works is that you start off, the monastery is kind of spread over 15 acres, and there's a bunch of cloister and stuff. And there's some kind of twists and turns and stuff. You start off at one end of the property at the guest house, and then you kind of wind your way down to the Buddha Hall through the cloister and kind of around some corners. And you do this in procession with all the other people who are doing Jukai, all the other lay trainees who are doing Jukai. And you do this at a fairly slow pace. I think it takes usually, what, 5-7 minutes to walk from the, maybe 10 minutes to walk from the guest house down to the Buddha Hall. For this ceremony, they do it at a fairly slow pace, not exactly walking meditation pace, but fairly slow. And so it might take you 25 minutes, 30 minutes to get to the meditation hall. You're walking along, and your hands in gesho as you're walking, and everybody is chanting, Hail Shakyamuni Buddha, Hail Shakyamuni Buddha. You chant that over and over as you're going along. And there's two monks leading the procession in there, tinging signal gongs that are alternately have a different note that correspond to the note of the chant. It's kind of fun because you're going along and there are times when part of the procession is going around a corner and the back of the procession is kind of following it up and the chant gets off. So then you kind of come around the corner and you realize, oh, I got to change the chant pace. And so there's all this adjusting going on and it requires a fair bit of concentration and awareness. And so as I say, you're kind of walking along. And what this is doing is sort of preparing you and saying, okay, I'm going to just continue to really work on having faith in the Buddha and what the Buddha taught. So then you wind around and you get into the Buddha Hall, which is prepared in a special way, and wind around some more, continually chanting. There's lots of incense going on. And you go, you're going along and you come to a shrine where there's a priest sitting in fancy formal robes with an alms bowl on the... Oh, no. This one is sitting in half gesho and has a pile of papers that they hand to you. And this priest represents Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of Compassion. And they're handing out these papers to people. And on the paper is written that confession verse, all wrong actions, behavior, and karma perpetrated by me. And this represents the compassion of the Buddhas. The Buddhas have said, okay, well, how do we help these beings here in this world? There's an interesting aside. In the Lotus Sutra, it says, there's a point where one of the Bodhisattvas is asking a Buddha who's talking, why do the beings in this particular world suffer? Why do they have to learn from suffering? And the Buddha says, well, in other realms they learn in different ways. In one realm that I know of, the beings learn from pleasant odors and scents. So whenever they have some issue that they need to learn about, it comes to them via their nose. Okay? So they smell things. In this realm, the beings are quite stubborn, so they need to learn through suffering. They like to hold on to their misunderstandings deeply, so they learn from suffering. Sad but true. So again, the compassion of the Buddha is saying, well, how can we help these beings? And we'll give them this verse which encapsulates this mind, which is saying what we need to really focus on as kind of human beings. We're kind of constantly looking outside of ourselves, and talked about this before, we're constantly looking outside of ourselves for the source of our suffering. We're constantly thinking, I'm suffering because so-and-so did such and such to me. I'm suffering because I don't have enough money. I'm suffering because I don't have the big screen TV that I want or the car that I want. If I only could get what I want, then I would feel this suffering. I'm suffering because I feel isolated. I'm suffering because of all of these different external circumstances. And make no mistake, many of these these external circumstances are difficult to bear. And I'm not trying to say they're not. But what the Buddha is saying is, well, let's look more deeply at that and find out how we can actually live in this world with a peaceful heart and not suffer within it. And what we need to be able to do then is get to relinquish our hold on those external, that external way of looking. And so out of compassion, the Buddha has given us this confession verse and said, well, look more closely at what you are doing, at what you, how you lead your life, the just decisions that you make and the choices that you make, and see whether they're influenced by greed, hate, and delusion. And be honest about that. Recognize it. Look closely at it. See what you are doing that creates suffering through acting on greed, hate, and delusion. That's a realm you can really do something about, what's going on in your own heart and mind. The external world, we have little influence on most of the time. And while we should, again, be responsible and take care, really the focus of our practice, and particularly for this week of Jukai, this retreat of Jukai, is to really home in on, really narrow in on what we're doing in our own minds and hearts, how we're creating suffering in that way. And that radically changes how we relate to the world. So then we receive this this confession verse, and we go along, and then we're kind of focusing on that. What am I doing? How am I doing? What's going on? What have I done to, how do I avoid admitting my mistakes? What are my mistakes? You know, what am I doing? And we're really trying to muster that willingness to say, yes, I have made mistakes. I don't necessarily see all of them. I don't necessarily understand all of them, but I've made them. This is not meant to be an occasion for despair. This is not meant to be an occasion for self-loathing. It's meant to be an occasion for upright and honest looking at myself. There's a phrase that we use in our tradition that we kind of refer to as sitting up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and ancestors. And it goes right to this mind of being willing to look clearly at what we have done, to being willing to see clearly what we have done, where we just sit up straight and we take the consequences. Okay, I'm willing, I did this, I'm willing to take the consequences. Let's have it. We just sit up straight in that kind of dignified, respectful manner, which is both dignified and respectful of ourselves, but also of the situation. So we sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha, and as we're walking along, Hail Shakyamuni Buddha, chanting this chant, this is what we're kind of contemplating. This is the contemplation of this meditation. So we continue on in our procession until we come to another shrine where there's another monk dressed, again, in fancy formal robes, who is holding an alms bowl. And that monk represents Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of universal love. And at this point, we take our confession verse and we put it into the alms bowl. Because part of our confession is being willing to relinquish the habit, is being willing to relinquish the pain of what we have done and or what has been done to us. We're giving it back to the Buddha. We're giving it back to the love of the unborn. We're making an offering of love ourselves. This confession and contrition is not an opportunity to for self-flagellation, for despair, or self-criticism in that kind of negative sense. It is an opportunity to say, here's this problem, and I want to do better. And the Buddha is kind of taking us at our word and giving us this opportunity. Okay, the way that we do better is we look carefully at what we have done, we confess it, we say, there it is, I did that thing, and boy, it hurts, or whatever. And being willing to give that back then to the Buddha in that sense. So we make this offering to Samantabhadra. And we continue on along until we come to another shrine. And there's another monk there, dressed again in fancy formal robes. And this shrine represents Shakyamuni Buddha. And he's got two assistants. And the assistants are, in a quite clear voice, reciting for us that confession verse. And this is a kind of point of recognition, the wisdom of the Buddha, is kind of there and saying, you know, in a sense, well done. Very good. This is how the Buddha's ancestors act. This is how the Buddha's ancestors behave. Continue on in your dignified way. Then we continue on, more winding around, procession. Everyone takes a seat out in another part of the hall. And the abbots, as they're called, the three bodhisattvas and buddhas, come out in procession, sit down, and burn up all of the... And they have the verses in a steel cauldron. No, and the verses in an alms bowl, there's a steel cauldron set in front of them with coals in it. And they take all of the... Sitting there ceremonially, they take all of the verses and toss them into the cauldron to burn them up, stir them up with pokers. So in other words, it is by this process of admitting our faults, offering them up to the Buddha for purification, that they are cleansed and released and returned to nothingness. So they stir them up and then... So this in this ceremony is embodied the process of how karma is converted, how karma is cleansed, how we can come to a deeper peace within ourselves. Remember again, I say this a lot, and forgive me, I just need to repeat things for my own self. The teaching of our tradition is all beings have Buddha nature, all beings are Buddha nature. Our problem is we don't see that. So our task is to come to see that, and the way that we come to see that is by saying, okay, well, what's covering it up? What's covering up Buddha nature? What's obscuring us? And it is these karmic habits that obscure Buddha nature within ourselves, that obscure the truth of non-suffering within ourselves. And so this ceremony embodies the process by which we, one of the steps of the process by which we come to understand and know Buddha nature within ourselves, by which we come to uncover Buddha nature within ourselves, by which we uncover our own deep peace of mind. And this process embodies all the kind of virtues of being willing, being humble, being open, being vulnerable. Sometimes when you admit your mistakes, you know, I think to myself, God, I'm such an idiot. And I guess I just have to let people kind of know that I am. I'm just a human being and I have limitations. And there you go. It helps us along our way. So an example of how this works in practice, in just daily life practice. My stepfather was a professional house painter, and he kindly allowed me to work with him when I was a teenager, and he taught me really how to do that. And it was, in a sense, a great gift from him, because he was basically giving me a way of making a living in the world. I think he was quite worried that I would turn out to be that I wouldn't turn out to be an upstanding person, and so he was concerned about my moral welfare and made use of that opportunity to help me in that way. To my mind, it was a little oppressive. One of my co-workers, a very fine man, my stepfather's main assistant, once came to me and he said, "Well, you know, I'm kind of sorry that Jordan's such an asshole to you, but he really just, you know, really means well and is really just trying to help you." I had to think, okay. So he taught me how to paint, and I can do a reasonable job. I don't know that I could actually earn a living at it anymore these days, but I can do a reasonable job with it. But part of the consequence of the oppression is that I don't really like to do it very much. It's not really one of my favorite things. Somehow it just doesn't really. It's always kind of frustrating and tense. And this story represents a point a long way away and a long way along a process. And that process has been kind of digesting what my stepfather offered me and the way that he did it, and coming to understand his real love for me and my love for him and all of that. And so, you know, it's been many years that I've been kind of digesting this, so it's not like this kind of magic thing that's happened overnight. But the other day, we had a work day, and I've been working on the front door area and the window up above, and over a couple of work days, one where we washed up there, we kindly had the help of people to clean and wash up there, and then doing various work projects and stuff. And so over time, we really tried to kind of clean up the area and make it a little more presentable. And so in a recent work day, we had the help of two lay people, and they've been kind of training, practicing with us very solidly for a long time. I'll use their names out of respect for them. And they were just—I was kind of saying, "Oh, yeah, I don't really like to paint." They're like, "Oh, okay, fine." And so they just kind of dove in and just went to work, and it was great. I was kind of watching them. They don't really care about paint. They just start doing what needs to be done, and it made me think, "Oh, well, maybe I should look more closely at this." You know, it was kind of inspiring, but like, I should really look more closely at my own attitude here. And I realized, okay, well, there's this kind of frustration and tension, this kind of not really liking this. And I thought, well, how can I really have to, I see that is there, and that I, in a way, I'm doing that thing. I'm resisting what needs to be done. And that, in a way, is this kind of sangye process. I'm making a mistake here. And again, the lay people that I'm working with have, in their kind way, inadvertently, not without any deliberate intent, have pointed this out to me in a sense. So I think to myself, okay, well, what do I do? I guess I'll make an offering of this painting and try to put some love into it. I'll try to just, when I'm feeling like that, I'll just try to let that go, make an offering of it to the Buddha, and put a little love into the paint job. And it was kind of funny, because over time, just kind of working with my mind in that way, you know, I hate this. I'll let that go. Put a little love into it. Let that go. And by the end of the thing, I'm thinking, this is kind of nice. Oh, this paint is all right. I can actually do this. It's okay. And then by the end of the day, I'm thinking, boy, I like that. I want to do some more painting. And over the next couple of days when I wasn't able to get back to, I was kept thinking, when can I get back to painting? Again, it's not magic. This is a process that I've been kind of, this relationship with painting has been going on for some time. I've been working on it, working with it over time. But you can see how our just willingness to admit, our willingness to say, okay, I'm making a mistake here. What can I do about that? How can I make an offering of it? How can I offer it to the Buddha? How can I work on converting it? Can really radically change our own relationship to our own minds and what we're doing in the world. So, hopefully that made a little bit of sense. I'm feeling a little pollened today, so I don't know if my brain is really working very well. But one of the things I wanted to say is that one of the things that, from my perspective, I'm hoping to be doing, sometimes I feel like it's good and helpful to try to explain some part of the Dharma. I hope that you have the sense that I'm trying to do that from the perspective of a conversation, not trying to give any sort of ex cathedra statements about the ultimate truth of things, but more trying to explain, this is my understanding of it, how I see it, how I view it. See if that will help you, and also let's have a dialogue about that. Do you have any questions about that? What's going on? You know, does anything kind of strike you as strange? And to let you know also that my understanding of things will change. So 2 years from now, if I were to give the same talk, it would be different, and my understanding of it would be different, and my view of it would be different. So that's the spirit in which I'm offering offering the talks that I do, and I hope that these are going to be online. Anybody listening online who has a question or a thought, that they would kind of let me know about that. Say, you know, what's this about? Particularly if they think that I've said something deluded or wrong. I hope to make use of such feedback. So that's what I have to offer today. And maybe Hermester Rukazana is
pretty complete to me. Thank you. All right. Any questions or?
I had a question. It's about the small pieces of paper. It's easy for me to understand confessing something, and it's really easy for me to understand burning that bad thing that you did up. But the part about offering it as though it were something good is, I've heard it here. It's not a new idea. But it's a little bit difficult to understand because you're engaging in a somewhat of a discerning act of identifying something that needs to be confessed. And then it's like, it's good and bad at the same time because it's something that you would offer to the Buddha, but it's also something you want to get rid of because it's causing suffering.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a very interesting point. And you know, what I was talking about too is, and this is something that's really been coming up for me lately, is the idea of offering my mistakes up to the Buddha. I think I told you this story where there's a dialogue in the Dankaroku between a monk and a teacher, and the monk comes to the teacher and says, you know, I've got all these negative feelings and thoughts arising in my mind. What do I do with them? And the teacher says, well, send them off to the Western Paradise. And the monk says, well, won't they, you know, be happy and be peaceful there? And the monk says, well, yeah, that's the point. the teacher says, yeah, that's the point. The purpose of the Dharma, the purpose of practice, is compassion. The reason
it works, it's helpful, and yes, we recognize these things that we need to do something about. That doesn't mean we have to judge them. We let go of that judgmental mind while still always being aware of problems that arise, of difficulties when we call suffering for ourselves and others. And as Reverend Leon is so obviously demonstrating here how important, this is not for punishing ourselves. We're here to do something about ourselves. We're not here to beat ourselves up. We're here to find the truth. And we don't find the truth by hating ourselves. And that includes any part of ourselves, any part of those habits that we bring with us. And that's one of the reasons defilements tends to be the way this has long been translated. And I don't argue with what the original meaning of the word is. For me, I find it more useful to think of them as karmic habits, because that right there doesn't seem for me to have a judgmental tone to it. But they're still the same thing. They're just karmic habits of ignorance or anger or pride or whatever it is. And the only way I have found to begin to deal with them is through compassion. I beat myself up for years. It didn't help. I mean, you're welcome to continue. And if you make an offering of them, we think of an offering has to be something we like. Well, in fact, an offering is whatever helps in training. And in some ways, the obstacles to training, the things that we don't like, are even greater offerings. And part of the offering process is our being willing to say, I am willing to give this up. Because we cling to our suffering. Oh, I did this and I was so bad and I'm remembering it again and he said that and then I went there and we make an offering of that. We let it go. And we accept it, we embrace it.
And part of the thing is we, in this process, we're kind of saying, oh God, yeah, I did make a mistake and I don't want to do that anymore. And by being willing to make that offering up to the Buddha, we're kind of affirming that by saying, you know, please, in a sense, here's what is here, help me with this because I don't want to do this anymore. And the Buddha then, because of the compassion of the Buddha and the love of the Buddha, is going to help us to resolve that, to bring that thing to peace, to bring our own heavy heart to peace, because of the grief that we feel about having made this mistake. And so it is that sense of compassion, that sense of... There's an image of Samantabhadra that I just kind of keep coming back to. Samantabhadra on my altar, I've always felt... for a long time I've just had Avalokiteshvara on my altar, although... Anyway, so Samantabhadra rides on an elephant, and I always kind of mostly relate to the elephant because it's this kind of patient vehicle. He's just kind of patiently going along and removing obstacles from the path of Samantabhadra, looking at them lovingly, kind of setting them aside, going around some things, moving up things, patiently going forward. Our offering is this kind of steady willingness to bring all the kind of grief and suffering within ourselves to peace, to heal what we can, and to let go of and have the Buddha help us with what is there. And it is by being willing to take it out in a way and have it be seen by the Buddha and make an offering to the Buddha that the Buddha can then say, okay, well, what is the best way that we can help you with that? And bring this thing to peace.
And that really is a very important part of the offering. It's also an important part of the Sangha. The Sangha is, in a sense, bringing it out to your own consciousness. You know, we don't want to look at these things. We don't like them. And part of training is a willingness to see all wrong actions, behavior, and karma perpetrated from time immemorial have been and are caused by my own greed, hate, and delusion. We need to be willing to look at that, and that's, we can't do anything about it until we do, and that's part of the offering process. In a sense, it's public, but it's really just between you and the Buddha, but it's admitting it, in a sense, to the Buddha. And that's one of the ways you begin to get a handle on these things. You begin to find a way to deal with them. Because as long as you're pushing them away, hating them, not admitting them, there's nothing you can do about it. And the difficulty in admitting them is it hurts. We won't do it. And that's part of the offering. The offering helps because it part of the process somehow showers us with compassion. You know, we're a part of something greater than ourselves. You know, you can get the feeling that you've got to take care of all of it by yourself. And on one level, that's true. And on another level, there's so much help available. And that's a part of the offering, because making the offering is asking for that help.
There's a part of this too, which again, all along our training and all of the different kind of processes that we go through as we participate with the Sangha and what the Sangha is doing, they're helping us address really deep and profound things within ourselves. These retreats and ceremonies and trainings that we go through are really addressing something quite profound. To me, there is a profound thing within us, which a profoundly deep thing within us is deep suffering, which is that suffering of ignorance. Again, you know, one of those last fetters that we cut through. That suffering of ignorance, which believes to its own kind of horror in a certain way that we are separate, that we are a separate being, has this feeling of separation, which is, in my experience, deeply painful. And that feeling of suffering, of separation, is addressed in this process of offering. It is being willing to it's like, I'm sure you've probably encountered this in various kinds of fiction or whatever, where someone finally says, "God, I thought you hated me," and discovers, "No, in fact, I don't hate you. The person doesn't hate you," or whatever. And in a way, we're, in a sense, afraid to take out our mistakes and problems for the Buddha to see, because we're so deeply afraid that those mistakes mean that the separation that we feel is true. And by going through this process constantly over time, regularly over time, being like, "Oh God, here I go again, I made another mistake," we're just constantly deeply eroding away that sense of separation, because when we make this confession, what we are given back is the love of the Buddha. And it just takes as long as it takes for us to, on a profound level, to let go of that last fetter, that fetter of self-ignorance, of self-delusion. Does that make sense?
It makes sense that delusion or ignorance would be the last, because greed and hate seem more obvious, I guess.
They're a little more
painful. Not more painful, but more immediately painful.
They're a little more concrete, easy to kind of get your grips on.
Yeah.
This is quite different. It should be said, Sangha, the confession and contrition, is quite different than the popular conception, I put it popular conception, of confession in the Abrahamic traditions, and the whole idea of sin and confession in the Abrahamic traditions, where sin is a kind of crime against God and a sort of blot on our soul in the Abrahamic traditions. That is not how it is viewed and understood in Buddhism. There's a similar kind of thing that happens where if you go to confession, I understand, you actually feel much better after you've made your confession to the priest in Catholicism. And after doing the Sangha ceremony, there's a deep sense of kind of relief in the monastery. It's really quite amazing how that kind of comes about. But there is no idea of sin or in a sense a crime against God. There are these actions which have consequences. Some of the consequences of our actions are that turning away from Buddha nature, and creating an obscuration between Buddha nature. But that is the consequence of our action and not something that Buddha nature has done. It's not like we're being punished for something that we've done. Buddha nature just is there, is compassion, love, and wisdom, and is just there. And so we need to be able to begin to take down those walls that we've created.
Unfortunately, one of the consequences of these actions that we do is to convince ourselves of that separation, which just makes it that much more painful. And that's why it's such a compassionate thing to do, to begin to deal with it. So that we, over time, begin to erode that conviction.
I was just thinking that if we lose the delusion that we're a separate self, I mean, coming from a place of being fairly deluded about that, I'm not all that excited about being at one with certain aspects of this world, you know? Like, I don't want to be the same as some people or some things. I guess that's the same idea that would make me not understand offering something that I don't like to the Buddha. It's kind of the same thing.
As you train, your understanding of what a oneness with the world changes and deepens. Being one with the world does not mean partaking of worldliness. Just as making an offering does not mean that you have to think of this thing as a good thing or a bad thing. Just recognize that through training, these things get cleaned up in the world. What the Buddha discovered on enlightenment was that he and the world are already enlightened, so you don't see, well, that's not true. You see the world clearly, and you see the world as completely all right as it is. Now, again, that doesn't mean that you partake of the worldliness within it. And that's seeing with the eyes of a Buddha. And it can be difficult in the beginning to imagine this. It certainly was for me and still occasionally is. That accepting the world as it is somehow not acquiescing. And it's not. It's just simply accepting the world as it is. And that's the only. That's where you have to start if you're going to do something.
There's an idea, I think it's a phrase of Dogen's, that which perceives error is not in error itself. Part of the enlightenment of the Buddha, part of what Buddha nature is compassion, love, and wisdom. Being able to see what creates suffering and what does not. And part of the enlightenment of the Buddha is understanding how to not create suffering. And so the oneness that we're coming to and the peace that we're coming to is the oneness and peace of strength, the oneness and peace of deep compassion, the oneness and peace of wisdom. So we don't, as Master Rokusan has put it, we don't actually need to participate in the worldliness that's around us. And the offering is like, you know, our compost bin is full. I'm going to take the compost out and make an offering of the compost to the compost bin. And trusting, in a sense, what we're doing is kind of trusting the Buddha to know what to do with it. I wouldn't make that same offering. I wouldn't make that offering of compost to where Mess serves on for lunch. Because over time, I've come to understand the difference between compost and food. And in a way, that's how what we're doing with our own internal life. we're just sort of saying to the Buddha, okay, well, here's this thing. Boy, ugh. But please do what's wise with it. And in that sense, we can then make the most use of it, just as we can with our food scraps and make compost.
All right. So I guess if no one has anything else, we need to go home and do it to the best of our ability. And we wish you well in it.